The Music Business Worldwide podcast is supported by Volley Music, a leading financial management platform for the music industry. Volley enables you to track expenses, approve invoices, and make payments 24/7, 365 days a year. For your free trial, head to volleymusic.com. That's VOLYmusic.com.
Whether it's Blackstone, Apollo Global Management, or KKR, the modern music business is awash with large financial players looking to invest billions of dollars in music copyrights. Since launching in 2019, Tempo Music has been a relatively quiet entrant into this space, despite being backed with over $1 billion from another institutional financial giant in Providence Equity. Tempo Music was founded by a Providence veteran in Josh Empson, who joined us on this episode of the Music Business Worldwide podcast. Empson is now also Tempo Music's CEO, following the exit of Charisse Clark-Suarez earlier this year. Charisse has gone on to found Harborview, which now rivals Tempo and is backed with up to $1 billion of Apollo's money. According to Josh Empson, Tempo is deliberately quiet versus some of its competitors when it comes to headlines in the music trade media. However, he says the fund is building a worthy catalogue of music rights linked generally to hit albums and records that have been created in the past decade or two. Recent acquisition announcements from Tempo include a stake in the catalogue of 21 Pilots songwriter and co-frontman Tyler Joseph, while Tempo has this year also bought a majority stake in the master rights of two classic albums from Korn. With a rich history at both Providence and in investing in media and entertainment IP, Josh Empson moonlights today as director of Providence's European Media Partnership, a long-term big money partner of soccer giant Real Madrid. In this MBW podcast interview, we ask Empson all about Tempo's strategy going forward and how contingent that strategy might be on the fund's cozy relationship with Warner Music Group. We also get into how Empson believes the shape of the music business might change in the years ahead and why he and Tempo are quite so bullish on the future growth of value in music rights. Josh Empson, welcome to the Music Business Worldwide podcast.
Thank you, Tim. It's great to be here and great to be talking to you.
The first question I want to ask you really is about the marketplace itself and Tempo's positioning within it. So very simply, in an increasingly crowded catalog rights acquisition marketplace, what's Tempo's unique strategy?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there are two things in my mind that really set Tempo apart. And one is the artists that we focus on. So we're really focused on what we think of and call modern masters, which is artists who are still recording, still touring. They may be selling their first catalog now, but they may have another catalog coming right behind it in 5 or 10 years. So we think we're really engaging in partnerships with them over a long period of time, not just around the exploitation of their catalogs, which is obviously our trust and the thing that we take most seriously, but also around the work that they may do in the future. And so I think that for us makes these really rewarding and in many cases fairly involved relationships. Like Tyler Joseph, whose catalog we acquired of 21 Pilots, Tyler actually came on board as a senior advisor to Tempo and helping us figure out a little bit how better to service the artist community. That's the second part of our mission, is to be a bespoke partner. In every catalog acquisition that we make, we devise a particular strategy for that artist and for that catalog. And we build the infrastructure that we bring to the exploitation around that. We really try to focus on our core strengths, which are around data and technology and servicing the artist, and not focus on those things that are not in our core. And we think that's what allows us to stay nimble. So to date, you know, we haven't wanted to develop our own sync department because we've wanted to find those partners in the ecosystem that can serve us sync best. That just gets harder if you have your own departments that need to get product to push through them. It's kind of like the, you know, majors and indies dynamic.
I first heard of Tempo in end of 2019. That was when we got a press release through from Warner Music Group talking about the Providence money that had come in, the fact that this new entity, Tempo, was being created or existed. And that there was a special relationship, I think it's fair to say, between Warner and Tempo. Now, stab in the dark, my guess at that is you know, when copyrights are expiring or reverting from the Warner Music Group world, you guys are drafted in or able to have a conversation with songwriters, artists and their representatives, which is very interesting. My question to you is, how much of your strategy is contingent on your relationship with Warner?
I mean, it's a very important relationship to us because we think that those guys are just, you know, really good at what they do. But I think we still try to find the best approach for an individual catalog. The value of Warner, and I think it's an enormous value, is, you know, going back to the idea of some folks have departments in-house. We could work very long and spend a lot of money and not get anywhere close to the global infrastructure that Warner has. So we get an enormous uplift when we work with them strategically, because there are just so many things that we can borrow from their system due to that enormous global footprint and the very high quality of people who work there, to kind of give us an uplift in a way that if we had to build that ourselves inside of Tempo, I mean, imagine what that lift would be. So they're doing something very different from what Tempo does, and it's really complementary. And, you know, so long as that's going to enable us to provide the best path for the catalog and the artists forward, we're going to work with Warner as much as we can, because, you know, we do have a great relationship with them.
As you point out there, the relationship works both ways. I only really pointed out the idea of the expiring or reverting copyrights. But of course, if you keep them, then I suppose there's a preferred administration or distribution relationship that you can keep those rights in the Warner Music Group universe as much as anything else.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we have acquired a number of catalogs that have been administered by Warner, and we've moved some catalogs over to Warner to be administered. And, you know, I think that's been beneficial on both sides because it makes it a deeper relationship. There is a certain fallacy in sort of saying, if I were to say, like, Warner is a great music company. In order to be a great music company, I need to replicate Warner. You know, we want to be a great music company that performs a very defined service for the artist and can, you know, meet our purpose with great focus. And I can't imagine being able to stay focused and trying to replicate all that infrastructure. So it's really beneficial for us to work with them because they've done that. And being able to dip in and out and work with their system dynamically, whether on administration or whether on sync or whatever it is that we would be doing, it is really efficient. They're certainly not the only partner that we work with, but I do think it's probably fair to say that is our deepest relationship on the administration side.
At some point, we were going to have to talk about money itself. And I'm interested to know what is Tempo's spending power in the market today? Because when Tempo was unveiled, I suppose, rather than announced in that end of 2019 Warner press release, I think there was a $650 million figure bandied around as your sort of capacity at the time. Your website for some time has now said that Tempo has $1 billion plus spending capacity. What's your capacity as we stand today? Because obviously these things change, more money comes in, you know, there's more flexible debt arrangements that take place. Like, what's your war chest looking like as we stand right now?
It's north of $1 billion now. I mean, the key thing to understand about Tempo, and this is a lot easier thing to explain as KKR and Blackstone, for example, have come into this space, is Tempo is a wholly owned subsidiary of Providence Equity Partners, which manages $50 billion in capital commitments. So we are an extension of a very deep pool. And as long as there are compelling investments to be made, there's not really a limit to how much capital we can put to work. And I'd say the same thing of KKR or Blackstone. If they want to go deep into this space, they can deploy a lot more than the $1 billion that was talked about in press releases. And I think it's very much the same for Providence. It's a little different than, I think, some of the first generation of folks who are here, who are operating, you know, specific funds with a specific amount of capital commitments and a specific amount of dry powder. I think the recent trend that we've seen for Tempo and the others that I mentioned is really to sort of be an extension of a much larger pool, with the potential for sort of more dynamic allocation.
Thank you. And before I ask this little addition to that question, I'll point out, obviously, you speak on behalf of Tempo and Tempo only, not Providence itself. But do you pick up that there's the hunger, the appetite at Providence to keep the funds coming into music? You know, I'm sure it helps in terms of confidence to look around and see their peers in the investment world investing so heavily. But is your feeling with the way that you work with Providence that there's more to come?
Yeah, I think there's more to come so long as, I mean, we're quite active in the market right now. And I think there's more to come so long as we're able to find great investments to make. I don't ever doubt that whether it's Providence or KKR or Blackstone, so long as the investment case is there to be made and there are great investments in the market, there will be capital to support them, you know, from Providence, from KKR, from Blackstone, from others.
You've been seen in some quarters as perhaps not as active as some of your competitors in the market in terms of big name deals that have hit headlines over the past 2 years or so. There has been a change of leadership, I believe, at Tempo. I know you've been there a long time, but the change of CEO with you coming in and Charisse going out. I mean, what's the situation now? Has your strategy changed at all? Are you more active in the marketplace? Is there a reason why perhaps you weren't as active as a primary wave or a Hypnosis going back a year or two?
Yeah, the strategy, interestingly, really hasn't changed at all. And the pacing of our investments really haven't changed at all since inception. I mean, if you sort of go back and look at, you know, what we did, what we're doing this year, what we've done last year, it's been pretty consistent. It's never been our interest to kind of make a lot of noise or make a big deal about what we're doing, but we've been slow and steady and very choosy. I mean, we are trying to pursue a very specific strategy. We're not trying to buy every catalog. We're not trying to sort of index the market. And we're certainly not trying to make headlines by doing the big superstar catalogs. We'd be happy to do them. It's not really our focus, though. Our focus is supporting these modern masters and investing in catalogs where we think we can develop a return for ourselves and for the artist by continuing to develop them and having a plan to continue to grow the catalog. And not every catalog is going to fit that. I mean, we've looked at 400 catalogs since we started Tempo. We've executed on many less than 400 of them because we're looking for a specific kind of catalog that we can develop in a certain way. We're probably never going to mean that we're the number one player in the market in terms of volume because we're not really after volume. We're after a return and we're after great partnerships with artists that we actually think we can continue to work with over time.
I find this modern masters strategy really interesting. I appreciate, by the way, that you're talking about masters as in like masters of their craft as opposed to master recordings. Make that clear. People are half listening. You know, there's a lot of discussion in this world about decay curves. You've got Bob Dylan, who obviously I consider, I'm imagining you would consider to be a sort of evergreen cultural icon who's going to last forever and whose imprint, both artistically and culturally, is not going anywhere. It's almost permanent in the fabric of society. But then again, who's to say that in 50 years' time, someone who's considerably younger than me is going to be particularly interested in that? Hopefully they are. And then you look at your friends over at Warner. They paid a lot of money for David Guetta's catalog, which David Guetta, for all of his positives to me, perhaps seems like that catalog would be forgotten about quicker than Bob Dylan. But who's to say? Because young people are growing up with that now, are forming emotional attachments with that musical where 5-10 years ago, that are now lasting into their 20s, 30s and on. So it's a very, very interesting idea. How does the value of music decay? And how do you make a call on that? And you operating in this modern masters space, you're basically taking on a fair amount of risk. You don't have a vast historical performance to base your valuation on, or indeed your forecast for what this music's going to bring in. So I'm just interested to dig a little more deeper into why you've chosen that, you know, what some people would call shallow catalog, you're calling modern masters, why you've chosen that as your area of focus.
So many of the conversations I'm sure you're having these days, Tim, go back to this sort of big bang moment, the sort of Cambrian explosion of streaming and all the changes that that has brought to our industry. One of those many benefits has been an explosion of data and information around the consumption of music. And it has given us the ability to, as we look at catalogs, really lead with technology and use the data that we can observe to kind of have some insights about catalogs earlier than I think you could 10 or 20 years ago. I mean, if you're talking about a catalog that has been stable for 20 years, it's not hard to value that catalog. I mean, the performance of that catalog is pretty easily observable. It's not that hard a thing to do to forecast its performance going forward. Now, you can have assumptions that you make about how you can work that catalog differently from its current state. And, you know, maybe Universal and Sony did that with the Dylan and the Simon catalogs. But I think what we're trying to do is look earlier in the life cycle of music and be able to make that prediction with confidence in a way that really hasn't been possible before. And we sort of think that's what makes this moment exciting in catalog. And that's what informed the strategy for us. And it enables these partnerships with artists who are still productive and in the middle or early phase of their career, which we think is so exciting in a streaming world where you can continue to sort of build around them.
We touched on a couple of these names before, Blackstone, KKR. We've also seen Apollo Global Management. They're bringing up to $1 billion, I believe, into a new fund run by Charisse, who used to run Tempo. So there's a connection there. Does the influx of big money, if you like, into the marketplace, these big names, Blackstone, KKR, Apollo, does that worry you or excite you about what's going to happen in the business and in Tempo's realm in the next few years?
Look, I think ultimately what's best for the business is what's best for artists and sort of give artists the most fuel to create and make great music. And I think more money coming into music is a good thing for everybody. I'm sure that it'll make the market for catalog more competitive. It already has over the last couple of years. That's really healthy. Transparent, efficient, liquid markets allow artists, you know, musicians and writers to realize the benefit of the content that they create, just the same way that, you know, for example, a software engineer who develops a great software product can get paid in the IPO market when they take their company public. This is really no different. An artist who makes great intellectual property can get paid for great intellectual property, and they can get paid much sooner in the life of that creation than they otherwise would have. So I think that's really good. And I think it's really good for artists. I think it's really healthy for the industry. We're really excited to be part of it. We're going to have to continue to compete harder and differentiate ourselves more. And you know what? That's the way markets should work. And we should be asked to sort of raise the bar and differentiate ourselves and provide more service to the artists that we partner with. You know, that's how you know, we earn our keep. The artists earn their keep because they're creating great content. And our job is to make sure that they can get paid the top dollar for that by creating a competitive market. So we welcome that. And look, you know, Providence has competed against Blackstone and KKR and Apollo for decades in other areas. So I have a lot of respect for them, but you know, it doesn't sort of seem, oh, well, now we'll be competing against the same people that we've competed against in other areas over decades. That doesn't necessarily scare us. I think it's actually a really healthy development and sort of the professionalizing of a space that you know, was really dominated by, you know, by smaller players before now.
We actually talked earlier in the conversation, you were mentioning that, you know, there was a trend prior to Providence and prior to Tempo, certainly prior to, you know, what we'd call the last 6 months to 12 months of investment into music rights. There was a period where people were using finite amounts of capital to buy up rights with investors who were looking for a return. Now, we've seen Cobalt just the other week sell a big catalog to KKR for $1.1 billion, and there was a big return of investment on that to people that provided the funding in the first place. And we've also seen Downtown sell a big catalog to Concord. Do you think this is a trend where buyers are going to start becoming sellers, people that we've gotten used to seeing as buyers, acquisitive entities in the music rights space, sell their catalogs on?
I do. I think that we've seen some of that, and we'll probably see some more of that. And that's a natural rotation. You know, as you see the market get deeper and more liquid and there's greater capacity, I think that it's natural to see assets change hands at all levels, you know, at the artist level where there's been an influx of catalog for sale, but also at the traditional holders of catalogs. because those assets should go to sort of the natural long-term owners. And I think, again, I think that's pretty healthy and normal and is the kind of consolidation you'd see in other industries. And, you know, Downtown and Cobalt didn't sell their companies. You know, those are still operating companies performing their core functions. They sort of, if you will, separated the opco from the propco, you know, the operating company from the entity that primarily held assets. As those assets found a lower cost of capital than was implied by the operating businesses. And traditionally, there's a certain sort of cost of capital for a business that is really an operator. And there's a different, you know, different cost of capital for a business that holds primarily assets. You know, you see analogies to that in other industries. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing happening here is the separation of those two kinds of assets.
I wanted to ask you to sort of scope out the amount of growth that you see ahead in the music industry, obviously in terms of streaming growth globally, be that through subscriptions and advertising, but also in terms of these alternative platforms we're hearing a lot about now, Roblox, Peloton, Facebook, and on. You know, I don't need you to paint exact the trajectory that you're seeing ahead of us, but maybe give us a feel as to Tempo's bullishness in terms of the growth in value of music rights in the years ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I want to kind of put that question right back on you, Tim. You have a lot of interesting conversations about that. I mean, we're pretty bullish. I think that, you know, some of the new uses are particularly exciting. I think streaming penetration has some more room to go, you know, particularly outside of the US and Europe. So I think that we're pretty optimistic, but I'm curious kind of what, you know, I certainly don't have a crystal ball on that one. I mean, what do you think? What are you hearing?
Well, it all looks ultra positive at the minute, right? There doesn't seem to be a negative bump in the road. You look at what Steve Cooper at Warner was saying the other week, you know, publicly and on the record, that Warner is now turning over on a run rate $235 million from these alternative platforms. Although how much of that is coming from Facebook? And obviously Facebook's potential in and of itself is a very interesting and exciting thing. You know, there are potential bumps in the road. There are things that streaming services, particularly Spotify, which is a more pure play streaming service than others, could do that could hurt the growth. There are deals to be done and licensing renewals that could hurt the growth. But right now, it just seems that the industry is firing on so many cylinders that even when something perhaps doesn't hit a forecast or something disappoints slightly, there'll be another part of the industry that is born or that grows quicker than everyone was expecting to pick up the pace. So I think that's pretty much the overarching view I have at the minute, is it seems to be new money is coming from everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you're right. And you know, all that without sort of saying, hey, we've been going through this, you know, this pandemic, and we've seen, you know, really no significant amount of touring in a while. And that's going to come back. And I think that's going to excite everybody. A lot of new music hasn't dropped as people have not been able to collaborate as easily. Some great new music has dropped, but you know, you can sort of see new releases picking up, and you could see touring picking up in the next couple of years. And I think that's probably another tailwind just in terms of people's overall enthusiasm about the space. So, you know, I certainly don't have a crystal ball, and, you know, every form of media has this latent vulnerability to distribution shifts happening, right? And sometimes those are fantastically positive, as streaming has been for music and video, but, you know, something like that could be out there. I honestly don't know what it would be right now. It's just difficult to come up for me with, you know, what is the event, you know, what is the big shock that hits music that sort of changes this rosy picture? I don't know what it would be. Now that maybe that's the way it happens, right? It's the thing that nobody sees that gets you. But we spend a lot of time sort of asking ourselves that question. And I don't think we've sort of come up with what the bear case is out there, other than, oh, maybe does streaming slow down a little faster than people expected? You know, maybe did things settle? But, you know, those are sort of a little bit of friction on the macro trends. It's not something that would sort of reverse the market, you know? I mean, maybe things slow down a little bit is sort of, I think, the worst thing that you could probably say right now.
Yeah, I've heard a bit of chat from clever people around fears around decentralized networks where effectively a piece of media can live and is is impossible to take down and is accessible by anyone anywhere and arguably could become untraceable. But even when I hear that possibility discussed, I think that music is in a real privileged position right now versus other industries, because it's already been through the pain factor once, harder than any other entertainment industry, any other rights industry in terms of piracy, purely because of the fact that music was a smaller file size. It was easier to move around on the torrent services, on Pirate Bay, etc. Music exploded on piracy and it wiped out all the value. And the music industry had to rebuild from that point. And that's why I think the sort of decentralized networks idea, although scary, it just, as you pointed out, it just wouldn't be the explosion that it once was. People like the convenience of a Spotify and Apple Music, YouTube, and etc. And the music industry has grown used to that being the paradigm, that being the effectively give music away, hope to get a little bit of money from advertising and funnel people towards a subscription. That it's worked so well so far that I don't really see a huge amount of danger to that model.
Yeah, no, I really think you're right. And let's not forget, the music industry didn't, I think it's fair to say, didn't sort of respond as well as it could have at first to, you know, Napster. You know, they didn't see it as this is streaming. They just saw the piracy. And so the music wasn't available anywhere in that format. And I think part of why music exploded on sort of Napster and Pirate Bay and the torrent sites was, for at least at first, there wasn't a way to get to sort of pay for the same product that people were stealing. And that became, I think, a bit of a snowball rolling downhill. And, you know, the music industry didn't respond well at first, but I think, you know, and Hollywood did respond a little better. Then Hollywood didn't play Netflix nearly as well as I think the music industry played Spotify. So I think they've sort of, you know, come back, and you'd have to sort of give them the upper hand as you'd compare, you know, video and music and kind of who's doing better. Certainly the labels seem to be, you know, hanging in there better than a lot of the legacy studios are. And we have never seen the kind of verticalization of content production music that you see in film and TV right now. So I think they're, you know, strategically maybe in a little better position than they were at the beginning of the streaming revolution. And I think they were just caught hugely off guard. And I think your point on bandwidth is a really good one, because it's just where we're going in a 5G world. It's just file size is not going to matter anymore.
Yeah. And music's been through the pain point that may or may not be coming to other industries. We'll see how well they protect their walled gardens. One question I definitely want to ask you is, because there's been so much talk around the prices that are being paid, the multiples that are being paid. You know, I've always got an eye on a headline, so forgive me. But do you think we'll see a $500 million or even $1 billion single artist catalog deal in the years ahead? And I, when I say artist, I obviously mean single artist and or songwriter and or songwriting collective sale in the years ahead. We've talked a lot about Queen and the Beatles, and there's many more that may come on the market at some point. I'm just wondering if that $500 million plus price point is a realistic prospect from your perspective.
It's really a great question, and I would certainly never say never, because, you know, who knows where it goes. I mean, my other great sort of personal and investing, you know, business passion is sports, and I've done a lot around European football and you know, soccer in the US as well. And I still remember that era a few years back of you know, just transfer fees that just seemed like there was absolutely no ceiling to them. And, you know, Neymar going to PSG, and, you know, how high can it go? And what you saw is that there's still huge transfers out there, but at some point, people, I think particularly some of the better managed teams started focusing on, well, you know, I can't just do it all in the transfer market. I need to actually, you know, find some younger players, develop them, put the side together in a cohesive way. And it's just not enough to grab a superstar and drop them in. I don't know. Maybe that's where some of these blockbuster sales go. And you can, if you go do a $500 million or $1 billion catalog purchase, you know, you better really have a plan as to what you're going to do for that and how you're going to make it better. And, you know, part of why we focus on this modern masters, literally in my mind, Tim, it's sort of like I do a lot of work with Real Madrid. And, you know, the idea is you need a deep roster of great young players. That's proven to be sort of the winning formula in football. And I kind of think it's going to be a winning formula in music as well. But I certainly would not rule out, just like I wouldn't, you know, rule out a huge transfer for a superstar in the football world. I wouldn't rule out that we're going to see a huge catalog purchase. Could it be $500 million or $1 billion? There are certainly some catalogs out there, which at the multiples that we see at the top end of the market, you know, could command that. I think it's absolutely possible. I'd love to put that one back on you too, because I think you probably have at least as good a perspective on that as I do.
Well, I love the football soccer analogy, because I'm trying to think, at the time we record this, Cristiano Ronaldo's gone back to Manchester United. And it is the exact dynamic that you're talking about. They've got this incredibly talented superstar footballer, arguably the best of all time. We could have the Messi Ronaldo debate all day. But, you know, Manchester United are really struggling to balance their team, and they're losing games that they would have previously, arguably without him, fought a lot harder in and been more competitive in. But to come back to what you just asked me about the $500 million or $1 billion single artist deals, I think it's certainly possible. I think perhaps the thing that I'm really keeping an eye on is I see Spotify, obviously, but also Amazon spending huge nine-figure sums on podcast acquisitions. Spotify acquired the exclusive rights, at least for a certain time period. We don't know what, but time period for Joe Rogan. And then Amazon acquired, I believe it's called Wondery. They did that big podcast content deal around the holidays. Gosh, time flies during lockdown, but I think it was last year. And I'm just wondering, like, when their appetite switches to the Paul McCartney catalog has become available, or, you know, the Ed Sheeran catalog, whatever it might be, you know, the idea that they could make an acquisition with a strategic digital play in mind, i.e. locking down exclusive rights to a certain set of music, that really interests me. Because at the minute we are talking about, you know, the Providences and the KKRs and the Blackstones. But, you know, when do the tech giants get their head turned? And we've also seen in the past, I believe the lawyer Joel Katz once revealed at Meetup, I remember it very well, like it was yesterday, in fact, he admitted that Google had made an interested call to buy, I believe, 50% of what was Sony ATV, the world's biggest music publisher at the time. It may have been the Jackson proportion, but it was a big chunk of Sony ATV, and Google were making a beeline for it. I mean, they didn't get it in the end. But I just find that really interesting, that could be a big shakeup in the power balance of the industry, as if the digital side, Tencent, you know, Spotify less likely, but who knows, they could raise some capital out somewhere. But certainly Tencent, Amazon, Apple start to get really interested in acquiring music rights and using them to their strategic advantage.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really interesting thought to me. And, you know, you think about it, if there continues to be a model where music is freely licensable to, you know, pretty much the entire universe of music is freely licensable to anybody who's willing to pay the fee, you know, is willing to pay the tariff. That's one strategic landscape for the tech giants. If you saw something happen, such as happened in video, where if Universal came out tomorrow and said, you know, we're going to do our own streaming service, you know, we're going to do our own version of Tidal, and we're only going to have our music, and we're not going to share with anybody else, which is sort of, you know, what happened in film and TV, that's really scary to the tech giants. That doesn't seem to be the direction of travel right now. You know, the people who control the intellectual property seem to be willing to freely license it and not verticalize their distribution. But man, if I were Google or Amazon, I would certainly be thinking about what my contingency plan would be if that started to happen. And it's not irrational to say, hey, if we owned, you know, Sony ATV, if we, you know, own one of the big catalogs out there, that would at least give us the ability to play tit for tat if someone is gonna mess with us. So I think it's a really provocative and interesting thought, and something I think those folks have to be thinking about.
Yeah, you're quite right. Everyone at the minute is sort of keeping their swords sheathed, if you like, you know, everyone, you know, pretending to be frenemies, don't they? They call them. Right. I think that's the situation everyone's in. But hey, everyone is turning over enough revenue and seeing enough growth in the market that everyone seems to be happy. I guess it all goes back to our earlier point that what happens if a slowdown ever occurs? That will be the moment that people start making arguably rasher decisions or making land grabs for power. Josh, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Obviously, thanks so much for giving us more of a sense, I guess, of what Tempo's strategy is and what we can expect from you in the market. Also, thank you so much for your time and thank you for joining the MBW podcast.
Thank you, Tim. It's been a pleasure.